We're talking about experiencing depression or anxiety. It's epidemic proportions. We've heard that said so many times over and over again. But what if all the things we've been told about this are wrong? That's the question posed by my next guest, Johan Hari. This has been quite the journey for you too, hasn't it?
Yeah, this was a really personal journey for me. It led me to write a book about this. It's called Lost Connections. I'm nearly 40, and every year that I've been alive, depression and anxiety have increased across the Western world.
You've got a lot to answer for, obviously.
Exactly, I blame myself. And Australia is actually off the scale. Australia's the second. You look at the international league tables of people taking antidepressants. Australia is number two behind Iceland, where there's like 10 people, and one of them is Bjork. And, I know this is personal for me because I remember when I was a teenager, I went to my doctor and I explained that I had this feeling like pain was kind of leaking out of me and I couldn't control it or regulate it. I felt quite ashamed of it. And my doctor told me a story about why I felt this way, which a lot of your listeners will have been told. And I now know that that story was oversimplified. I think dangerously oversimplified. My doctor said, we know why people feel like this. Some people just naturally have a chemical imbalance in their brains. They lack a chemical called serotonin. You're clearly one of them. All you need to do is take these drugs and you're going to feel better. So I started taking an antidepressant called Seroxat, which did make me feel a fair bit better at first. After a few months, the effect kind of wore off a bit. So I went back, I took a higher dose. Again, I felt real relief from the drug. Again, the effect wore off and I carried on jacking up the dose until for 13 years I was taking the maximum possible dose that you can take. At the end of which I was still depressed and I started thinking, well, what's going on here? Mm. Because if it's just a problem in our brains, why are so many more people becoming depressed and anxious? There must be something missing in what I've been told.
Well, it's a mathematical equation by that story, isn't it? You know, you got low levels, you boost them up. That's supposed to be your problem solved, isn't it?
Exactly. And it's a comforting story and it's a story that I was comforted by. But when I went, so I then spent 3 years traveling all over the world, interviewing the leading scientific experts on what causes depression and anxiety and what we can do about them. And I was quite startled to learn that there's actually scientific evidence for 9 different causes of depression and anxiety. One of them is, in fact, biological. There are real genetic factors that can make you a bit more vulnerable to this. And there are real brain changes that happen when you become depressed that can make it a bit harder to get out. But most of the things that are causing this epidemic of depression and anxiety are not factors in our biology. They're factors in the way we live. And that requires a very different set of solutions. And I went to places where they tried these solutions. So I'll give you a concrete example. I think all your listeners will just, so many of them will feel in their own lives. There's been an explosion in loneliness across the Western world. There's a study that asks Americans, for example, how many close friends do you have who you could turn to in a crisis? And when they started doing it years ago, the most common answer was 5. Today, the most common answer is none. There are more people who have no one to turn to than any other option. And we know there's lots of scientific evidence that loneliness causes depression and anxiety. So I wanted to think, well, what can we do about it? In a sense, what's the antidepressant for that, right? And so I started meeting lots of people. And one of the heroes of my book, Lost Connections, is a guy called Dr. Sam Everington. He's a GP in East London, where I'm from. And Sam was very uncomfortable because he had loads of patients coming to him with terrible depression and anxiety. And like me, he's not opposed to chemical antidepressants. He thinks they have some role to play, a positive role to play. But he could also just see most of the people he was giving them to continue to be depressed. And he could see that they were depressed for perfectly understandable reasons to do with their lives. So he decided to pioneer a different approach. One day, a woman came to him called Lisa Cunningham, who I got to know quite well. Lisa had been shut away in her home with just crushing depression and anxiety for 7 years. And Sam said to Lisa, "Don't worry, I'll carry on giving you the drugs. I'm also going to prescribe something else. I'm going to prescribe for you to take part in a group." There was an area behind the doctor's surgery that was just scrubland, right? Just dogs would go and mess in it. He said, "What I'd like you to do is come and turn up twice a week. I'm going to come and support you. And with a group of other depressed and anxious people, we're going to turn this scrubland into a garden." The first time they met, the first meeting, Lisa was literally physically sick with anxiety. Because she'd barely been out of the house. The pressure of being around people was terrible for her. But a few things happened. The first thing was the group, these are inner city East London people, didn't know anything about gardening. They started to get their fingers in the soil. They started to learn the rhythms of the seasons. They started to reconnect with the natural world. There's a lot of evidence that's a very powerful antidepressant. And then an even more powerful thing happened. They started to get to know each other. They formed a group, a tribe. They started to care about each other. They started to notice if one of them didn't turn up. They started to solve each other's problems. The way Lisa put it to me, as the garden began to bloom, we began to bloom. There was a study in Norway of a very similar program, found it was more than twice as effective as chemical antidepressants. And this is something I saw all over the world. The most effective strategies for dealing with depression and anxiety are the ones that deal with the underlying reasons why we're feeling so bad. And to me, the problem with, if I think about what I was told as a teenager by my doctor, and you know, I don't blame my doctor, they've got 5 minutes to see patients, they're very stressed out. I'm sure my doctor thought he was doing the right thing. But if you tell people a story that it's just a problem in your brain, what that does is cuts you off and cuts the wider society off from finding the causes of this depression and anxiety that are rising all around us and dealing with those causes. There was one person who really made me think about this a bit differently. I went and interviewed a South African psychiatrist called Derek Summerfield. And Derek happened to be in Cambodia in 2001 when they first introduced chemical antidepressants mm-hmm. in that country. And the local doctors, the Cambodian doctors, had never heard of these drugs. So they said to him...
Because Cambodia doesn't have anything to be depressed about, do they?
Exactly. And they hadn't heard of this, so they asked him what they were. And he explained, and they said to him, oh, we don't need them, we've already got antidepressants. And he said, what do you mean? He thought they were going to talk about like a herbal remedy, like St. John's wort or something. Instead, they told him a story. There was a farmer in their community who one day stood on a landmine and got his leg blown off. We worked in the rice fields. So they gave him an artificial leg, and I think a few months later he went back to work in the fields. But apparently it's very painful to work underwater when you've got an artificial leg. I'm guessing it was traumatic for obvious reasons. The guy started to cry all day, didn't want to get out of bed, classic depression. So they said to Derek, well, that's when we gave him an antidepressant. And he said, well, what was it? And they said, well, we went and sat with him. We listened to him. We realized that his pain made sense. We figured if we bought him a cow, he could become a dairy farmer. He wouldn't be in this position that was making him so distressed. So they bought him a cow. Within a couple of weeks, his crying stopped. Within a month, he wasn't depressed anymore. They said to Derek, so you see, doctor, that cow, that was an antidepressant. That's what you mean, right? Now, if you've been raised to think about depression the way we have, that sounds like a joke, right? I went to my doctor for an antidepressant, he gave me a cow. But what those Cambodian doctors knew absolutely intuitively is what the leading medical body in the world, the World Health Organization, has been trying to tell us for years. If you're depressed, if you're anxious, you're not crazy. You're not a machine with broken parts. You're a human being with unmet needs. And what you deserve is love and practical support to get those needs met.
I just want to go back to something that you said right in the beginning, and that was you were told this story in relation to antidepressants and serotonin. You've talked to these scientists and come up with other things. How do you know that what these people are telling you is not just another story?
Yeah, I think
told the scientific evidence is there on serotonin, aren't we?
Yeah, it was kind of shocking, for example, to read, you know, the leading expert at Yale, Professor Andrew Scull, saying there's just no evidence that serotonin causes low depression. I went and spoke to the leading expert at Harvard Medical School, and they go through in great detail the evidence for this, that, and I also talk about this a bit in the book. But I think partly one of the ways we know this, and this will fit with what people see in their own lives. The scientific evidence will fit with what they see in their own lives. Everyone listening to your show, for example, knows they've got natural physical needs, right? Obviously, you need food, you need water, you need shelter, you need clean air. If I took them away from you, you'd be in trouble really quickly.
Yep.
There's equally strong evidence that human beings have natural psychological needs. And if you take them away from people, they feel terrible. You need to feel you belong. You need to feel your life has meaning and purpose. You need to feel that people see you and value you. You feel you've got a future that makes sense. And our culture is good at lots of things. I'm glad to be alive today. I love dentistry. I like Kylie. But we've been getting less and less good at meeting these deep underlying psychological needs. Oh, it's not the only thing that's going on, but I think it's the key reason why we've got this rising depression and anxiety crisis. If it was just a disorder in people's brains, you know, spontaneous problem like brain tumors or something, why would it be rising so much? You know, as loneliness rises, depression rises. There's a whole range of other factors to go through. 9 causes. I'll give you another example. Everyone knows that junk food has taken over our diets and made us mentally sick, physically sick, right? You can see from my chins that I'm a bit of a victim of that myself. There's equally strong evidence that a kind of junk values have taken over our minds and made us mentally sick. There's very good evidence from an amazing man called Professor Tim Kasser has put this together. The more you think life is about money and status and how you look to other people, the more likely you are to become depressed and anxious by quite a significant amount. And as a culture, we've just become much more obsessed with those things. I mean, Donald Trump is obviously an extreme symbol of that. Or I'll tell you about, give you an example of one of the causes of depression and anxiety that I write about that I found hardest to learn about. And if we've got time, I'll tell you the story of how it was discovered, because for a minute, you're going to think, why is he telling me this? This is what's got to do with depression. And I think it leads to a breakthrough, and it really helps to understand it if you hear the story. In the mid-1980s, a doctor I got to know later in California, in San Diego, called Dr. Vincent Felitti, was asked to do something quite difficult. The local medical provider was called Kaiser Permanente. And they came to him and they said, look, we've got a big problem. Obesity is exploding. And everything we're trying is not working, right? We give people diet advice. We even refer them to, you know, personal training. Nothing's working. It keeps going up. And they gave him quite a big budget and said, just do blue skies research, figure out what the hell we can do.
Yeah.
So he started to work with 250 exceptionally obese people, people who weigh more than 400 pounds. And he's interviewing them. And one day he had this idea that sounds a bit stupid, in a way is a bit stupid. He asked himself, what would happen if really obese people literally just stopped eating and I gave them like all the nutritional supplements like vitamin C so they didn't get scurvy and all of that? Would they just burn through the fat stores in their body until they got down to a healthy weight? So he started to do this, obviously with loads of medical supervision. And in one way, it worked. There's a woman who I'm going to call Susan to protect her medical confidentiality, who went down from being more than 400 pounds to 138 pounds. Incredible. People are massively celebrating. Her family tell Dr. Felitti that he saved her life. And then one day, something happened no one expected. Susan cracked. She went to KFC. She started obsessively eating. And quite soon, she was back to a dangerous weight. And Dr. Felitti called her in and said, Susan, what happened? She looked down. She was very ashamed. She said, I don't know. And he said to her, well, tell me about the day that you cracked. Did anything happen that day? Turned out something had happened that day that hadn't happened to Susan ever. She'd been in a bar and a man had hit on her. Not in a predatory way, but he'd expressed sexual interest in her. She'd felt really frightened. Vincent, at a later session, asked her, when did you start to put on weight? It never occurred to him to ask these people this before. With Susan, it was when she was 11. He said, well, did anything happen when you were 11 that didn't happen when you were 9, didn't happen when you were 15? And Susan looked down and she said, yeah, that's when my grandfather started to rape me. Vincent then interviewed everyone in the program. He discovered that 55% of them had put on their weight in the aftermath of sexual assault or abuse. Obviously, that's much higher than the wider population. He's thinking, well, what's going on here?
A protection to stop being attractive.
Exactly. That this thing that seems irrational, obesity, was actually performing a function. Mm. It was protecting. Susan said to him, overweight is overlooked. And that's what I need to be. But this was quite a small study, right? It's 250 people. So Dr. Felitti goes to the Center for Disease Control, the big medical body in the US, and he got funding to test everyone in the city of San Diego who comes for medical care. So whatever you went to your doctor for or to a hospital for, you were given, no matter what, broken legs, schizophrenia, anything, you were given a questionnaire, and it had two parts. First part said, did any of these 10 bad things happen to you when you were a kid? Things like neglect, sexual abuse, physical abuse. And then it said, have you had any of these problems as an adult? So they started with obesity. And then they added a few other things, depression, suicide attempts and addiction and other stuff. When the figures were calculated out by the Center for Disease Control, people thought there must have been some mistake. For every category of childhood trauma you experienced, you were 2 to 4 times more likely to experience depression. But when you got into the multiple categories, it was incredible. If you had 6 of those categories, you were 3,100% more likely to attempt suicide. And 4,600% more likely to become addicted. And I remember when I went to see Dr. Felitti, he's a wonderful man. If you met him, you'd really admire him, Sonia. And I remember walking out of his office the first time and almost shaking with anger. I was so angry. I kept thinking, why am I so angry with this man? Why am I reacting this way? And I realized, it was forcing me to think about something I didn't want to think about. When I was a child, I had experienced some very extreme acts from an adult in my life. You know, my mother had been ill, my dad was in a different country. And I had never thought about that in relation to my own depression. And I'd never been asked that. In the 13 years I was given chemical antidepressants, no one ever said, is there any reason you might feel this way? But one of the reasons I'm glad I went through that anger is because of what Dr. Felitti actually discovered next in his science, which was... So people had indicated on the form they might have experienced some form of childhood trauma. If you indicated you had, your doctor was told, next time this person comes in, so don't call them in, but next time they come in, say something like this to them. I see that when you were a child, you were sexually abused or whatever the abuse was. I'm really sorry that happened to you. That should never have happened. Would you like to talk about it? And about 40% of people wanted to talk about it. 40% didn't want to talk about it, 60% did. And the 60% who did wanted to talk about it on average for 5 minutes. And then it was randomized. Some of them were told, I can refer you to a therapist to talk about this more. What was incredible was just those 5 minutes of an authority figure saying, I'm really sorry, we'll let you down, that shouldn't have happened. That alone led to a really significant fall in depression and anxiety. And the people referred to a therapist had an even bigger fall. And what that shows us is part of a much wider body of evidence that shows us it's not the trauma that destroys you. It's shame about the trauma. Giving people places to release that shame is extraordinarily powerful. Now, I think that should be regarded as an antidepressant, right? Anything that reduces depression should be regarded as an antidepressant. And in a funny sort of way, you know, I go through these 9 causes of depression and anxiety in my book, Lost Connections, and I go through the solutions. But in a funny sort of way, as I was learning this, I kind of felt like I was learning something incredibly obvious, like I was being given permission to see the thing that was right in front of me all along. If you'd said to our grandmothers, right, do you think being lonely makes you more depressed? Do you think having a job you hate makes you more depressed? Do you think if you were sexually abused by a relative, you're more likely to be depressed? I think my grandmother and yours have looked and gone,
well, obviously.
Exactly. And yet somehow we've been taught to not see the things that are right in front of us, right? And we've been taught to focus entirely on a solution that takes us away from understanding those things rather than towards it. It's not that chemical antidepressants don't have some positive role to play for some people. They absolutely do. But we've got to deal with these deeper causes and this deeper story.
Yeah, interesting, because I've got a text here that says, I believe this is a Western disease. Humans have lost our tribal lives where you were never lonely and you had a purpose in life. Plus, we in the West are like adult children with no boundaries. These are all issues you addressed in this remarkable book called Lost Connections, which at the very least makes you think about things. I want to go because I want to just highlight the fact that within this you talk about the antidepressants and that the research has done that shows that they don't necessarily have much more than a passing improvement in many people's lives, but that research is often buried because it was done by the pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think the most important thing to know about antidepressants, they do give some relief to some people, but the most important evidence, I think, is the long-term research. So when you see this covered in the news, they say, studies showing antidepressants decisively work, right? And what those studies always look at is 8 weeks. And it was true for me as well. First 8 weeks, massive effect, right? But actually, the most important research, I think, to look at is something called the STAR-D trial, which is the long-term research into antidepressants. And what it shows is most people taking antidepressants do become depressed again, right? It doesn't mean it's not taking the edge off for some people, because it is, and that has real value. But we just got to be honest, everyone can see around them. For 30 years now, we have massively increased antidepressant prescriptions. And for 30 years now, every year we do it, depression continues to rise. It doesn't mean the drugs aren't causing the problem. They're taking the edge off the problem a bit, but there's something missing in that picture, right? Mm. And what's missing in that picture is what the World Health Organization, the leading medical body in the world, tells us, which is key factors in the way we're living. They say we need to talk less about chemical imbalances and more about power imbalances. So, for example, there's a lot of evidence that I go through in the book, discovered by an incredible Australian called Professor Michael Marmot, that if you go to work tomorrow and you feel controlled at work, so you have low or no choices about your work, you are much more likely to become depressed and anxious. Mm. So there's all sorts of factors that are in the way we live that we can change, right? And I went to places that have changed and challenged these things. There's no reason we should be living in ways that are making us more and more depressed. We can change that together.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonia. I really appreciate that.
Johan Hari.